Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new book, Chain of Title, today's guest, journalist David Dayan, tells the story of three foreclosure victims and how they uncovered an unparalleled pattern of deceit used by mortgage companies to take people's homes away. These three citizens played a significant role in uncovering what they call the largest consumer fraud in American history. They called it foreclosure fraud because millions of families were kicked out of their homes based on false evidence by mortgage companies that had no legal right to foreclose. Between 2006 and 2014, more than 9.3 million homeowners went through a foreclosure or lost their homes to foreclosure. And the question we are still asking today is, why hasn't anyone been held responsible? David Dayan is a contributing writer to Salon and The Intercept and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times and The New Republic. His new book is called Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David will be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park today at noon, 1010 El Camino Real, and he'll be at Book Passage in San Francisco tonight at 6 o'clock, 1 Ferry Building. And David Dayan joins us in studio. Hi, David. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. So I understand that since you began writing about foreclosures, you receive hundreds of emails still from angry homeowners. This is still happening.
I get letters every day. I get emails. I get registered letters at my house. I was telling you earlier that a guy came to one of my events, drove 4 hours from Chicago to St. Louis to tell me about his foreclosure story. He's been fighting for 11 years. So this is still around. People are fighting these things case by case, and I don't know when it's going to stop.
Before we dive into the information that these three people uncovered, the three ordinary Americans mm-hmm. you write about, let's remind everyone how we got to this place. You say that your book picks up where The Big Short left off, a really great movie based on the book.
Based on the book by Michael Lewis.
Thank you. Based on the book by Michael Lewis. I just watched the movie again to be reminded, and it's just so amazing what these banks and mortgage companies got away with.
Yeah. So The Big Short tells this story of securitization, that there was this need for mortgages because they figured out how to turn a mortgage into a bond that investors could buy, something they could trade. And the way that they did that was this very complex process of securitization. But once they got that in place and there was a lot of demand for these bonds, they had to issue more and more mortgages to keep up with that demand. And so lending standards just went out the window. They gave a mortgage to anyone with a pulse, basically. There's a part in my book where at Countrywide, which was one of these big mortgage companies, somebody had a vanity license plate and it was said, "Fund 'em." And this other executive asked, "What does that mean?" And he said, "Well, that's our CEO's strategy for 2006. Fund them. If they don't have a job, fund them. If they don't have any assets, fund them. If they can fog a mirror, they can get a loan." And that's what happened during the housing bubble. It drove up prices. It put people into loans they obviously couldn't afford. You started seeing people miss their first mortgage payment. You know there's a problem when they're missing the first payment. And eventually that was going to crash, and it did crash.
So people were given AAA ratings when they didn't deserve
them.
Well,
yeah, the bonds themselves were AAA rated. They were telling investors that this is never going to be a problem because we have thousands of mortgages packed into these bonds, and if a few of them fail, that's still not going to be a problem. You're still going to get paid. And, you know, they were basing that off of this assumption that the mortgages were of decent quality. But in fact, they were of terrible quality, and they all failed at once, basically. And that's those ratings were a fiction.
And also in the movie, which is based on true events, a couple of mortgage lenders say that they targeted specific people.
Oh, there's no question they targeted African-American communities, Hispanic communities. The largest amount of subprime loans were actually people who already had equity in their homes that they would do what is called a cash-out refinance. So they would refinance the mortgage and give people cash. This is people using their homes as an ATM machine to pay other bills because they were cash-strapped, but they had this money in their home. So you had people, you know, these mortgage brokers going into African-American, Hispanic communities, finding people who owned their home and giving them mortgages and then giving them a bunch of cash. And that worked maybe in the short term so they could, you know, deal with their other financial stresses and responsibilities. But it sucked the equity out of their homes, and it put them into these loans that were of terrible quality, where the interest rate would shoot up after 2 years, and it really devastated these communities.
And so a lot of people have heard about this aspect of what happened. And you had bankers, people who worked for Countrywide, for example. I remember when they went on 60 Minutes and basically blew the whistle, and yet the U.S. government did nothing.
Yeah. So you had fraud at sort of every level of the process. Origination, that's, you know, Countrywide, which wasn't a bank. It was a non-bank, actually, issuing these mortgages. You had the investment banks that bought the loans saying to investors, these are of high quality, when they sold the bonds out. But they weren't. So that was another level of fraud. You had homeowners, when they tried to get loan modifications, there was fraud in that process because they were told they could get a modification, and then they were rejected later and put into foreclosure. And then what's in my book is this idea of foreclosure fraud, which is that when the banks went through that process of transferring all the mortgages and getting them into these bonds, these trusts, and selling these bonds out, they didn't follow the steps that are rooted in property records law that go back to the 1630s, you know, 150 years before we had a constitution. We had these very specific public records laws that said, you know, when you transfer property, you have to write that down. This is the transfer. It goes from this person to this person. And you have to put that in a public office so everyone in the community has confidence that who owns what. And that's what they just didn't do, and they confused the ownership. And when they had to go back and foreclose on people, they had to create that evidentiary record after the fact.
It's hard to keep up with this. I mean, your head spins when you're talking. I'm trying to follow a graph. How did they come up with this complex and opaque lending structure? I mean, what I liked about the movie is that a lot of these bankers couldn't even describe this. They didn't even know how it worked.
Yeah, securitization was a very complex process designed by, people who would normally be engineers, you know, and mathematicians. They figured out how to take loans, bundle them together, and make bonds out of them, where different investors got different rates and different payouts based on certain factors. So that process was very complex and structured in a very deliberate way. However, the easy part of it, which is when you transfer a mortgage, write it down that one person got the mortgage and one person gave it up. That easy process is what they didn't do. And why didn't they do it? Well, it was very laborious and time-consuming and costly to actually do that process. These loans that were underlying the bonds were bad loans that shouldn't have been in this in these mortgage securities. And so if you don't write the paper, nobody knows that the loans are bad. And also, I think they did it because they knew they could get away with it. And events really played out that way.
So you tell the story in your book of three ordinary Americans who learned about this fraud and tried to do something about it. Lisa Epstein, Michael Redman, and Lynn
Simoniak.
Thank you, Simoniak. Mm-hmm. How did you learn about these three?
So there's a scene in the book where they go to Washington to this conference where people who are activists and writers and things are trying to get a handle on this foreclosure fraud situation. And I was at that meeting. So I met them about 6 years ago in 2010. And I followed this story in real time. They were sources of mine. And the common thread between Lynn, Michael, and Lisa is that they were all in foreclosure. They were not experts before the fact. They were not. They had no history of activism even. But they were in foreclosure, and when they got their foreclosure papers, they actually read them, which is a revolutionary kind of act because 95% of these foreclosure cases go uncontested. And so when they read these documents and then they got sort of obsessed with trying to figure out if there were patterns here, they started their own websites and they started writing about this fraud that was going on. They became really great sources of mine when I was trying to figure out and write about this situation. And when I learned their larger story, I knew it was one that I just had to tell.
So let's talk specifically about Lisa Epstein. She's mm-hmm. a cancer nurse who lives in Florida. Mm-hmm. And you report that several different entities had a connection to her loan. DHI Mortgage, JP Morgan Chase, Chase Home Finance, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank. Yeah. But the new company, Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, seemed to play no role in the securitization chain. I mean, how did she learn about this?
Yeah, so
because a lot of people tried to figure out who owned their loan,
right.
and they couldn't get that information.
It really started with her when she got her foreclosure papers and she saw that she was being sued by this entity, U.S. Bank. She had never heard of U.S. Bank before. There are no U.S. Bank branches in Florida. So she thought it was like a fictitious name, like U.S. Bank, like a bank in a movie or something. And she just wanted to know, who are these people and why are they trying to take my home away? She was writing her checks to Chase Home Finance. DHI Mortgage was the company who issued her mortgage. She didn't know who U.S. Bank was. And when she called them and said, you know, why are you suing me? They said, we have no record of Elisa Epstein. And she said, but you're suing me. You're trying to take my home away. Who are you? And they said, we're sorry. We don't know who you are. And that really piqued her curiosity. And that's why she went down this road. And she basically got herself a self-taught education on this entire process. She kind of learned what was in The Big Short by going through public records, by going through websites and looking at the SEC website and figuring this out piece by piece by piece by piece. She called it her sleepless phase, where she slept 3 hours a night for about 3 years and the rest of the time was on the internet, on the computer, trying to figure this out.
You also write about Michael Redman, and his story is different in that Freddie Mac securitized his loan.
Yeah, Freddie Mac, which is one of the big government-sponsored entities, securitized his loan. However, when he was foreclosed upon, the company JP Morgan Chase said they owned it and not Freddie Mac. And when he got the documentation, he found that the entities representing Freddie Mac, who transferred, allegedly, the mortgage over to JP Morgan Chase, actually worked for JP Morgan Chase. So JP Morgan Chase was assigning the mortgage to themselves. And this obviously was a revelation for Michael Redman, and he decided to, you know, really look through public records, see if there were patterns here. And he wrote up a guide to how to look up fraud in the public records. And when he posted that online, it went viral. And that's how he really got sucked in, and he started his own website, and that's how he, you know, became this figure.
So Lisa and Michael met, mm-hmm. and Michael published this online guide.
Yeah.
And then they connect with Lynn, a lawyer who investigates the signatures in her own foreclosure and finds one with a date when the signer was actually in state prison.
Yes. This individual, Carell Harp, was in state prison in Oklahoma at the time he allegedly signed the document. And the reason for that is that this, I call it the great foreclosure machine, these third-party companies were creating millions of documents. And they, in order to speed up the assembly line, would have anyone in the office sign for the person who was allegedly authorized to sign on behalf of banks. And so you had this individual, Linda Green. She was the vice president of 20 different banks, allegedly. I call her the lowest paid vice president of a bank in history. She was an auto parts worker before working at this third party company, DocX. And in the public records, because they let anyone sign the name Linda Green as the vice president of a bank, can find in the public records Linda Green's name in 20 different styles of handwriting.
Wow.
And they said, DocX said that they used Linda Green to be this vice president of these different banks because her name was easy to spell. Like, that was the reason why they singled her out, so everyone in the office could easily write Linda Green, Linda Green, Linda Green.
I mean, all of these stories are incredible, but Lynn's is also very incredible. A West Palm Beach attorney, again, she specializes in white-collar insurance fraud.
Yeah.
She fell into foreclosure in July 2008, got sued by the trustee of her mortgage, mm-hmm. Deutsche Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But when she finally received her mortgage assignment, it was dated October 17th, 2008, 3 months after Deutsche Bank filed for foreclosure.
Right.
So at the time of the foreclosure filing, Deutsche Bank didn't legally own the loan over which it sued her.
Well, by their own evidence, they didn't own the loan at the time that they sued her. And that was true in Lisa's case as well. And so you saw this. Basically, they were recreating a paper trail after the fact because they didn't create it at the time. And the problem with that is there are very specific functions that when you're creating a trust, you have to fund the trust within 90 days. And if you don't do that, then there's nothing actually in the trust. These mortgage-backed securities I talked about, they were actually nothing-backed securities because if the trust wasn't funded in time, that's it. There's one window, and if it closes, it's done. And so they were recreating this paper trail to try to cover up that real original sin.
Now, lucky for Lynn, she is a lawyer, mm-hmm. right? And so she was able to write the first official fraud report to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Jacksonville. I'm guessing this is probably very difficult for an average person with no law background to do, right?
And it was, and more so that she actually knew people in the Jacksonville U.S. Attorney's Office. She had worked with them on insurance fraud cases. She was an expert witness in some cases at the Jacksonville Attorney's Office. So it wasn't just that she was a lawyer and was able to explain this stuff. She had people she could go to that she knew would listen to her, at least hear her out at the initial level. And so that triggered an investigation, which was a legitimate investigation, involved dozens of FBI officials, hundreds of interviews. They got millions of documents. I've seen from a Freedom of Information Act request all of these documents that they got. Ultimately, that ended up, that investigation only indicted one person. And the rest of the investigation, it did not go up the chain. It indicted the CEO of that company, DocX, that employed Linda Green, but it didn't say, well, who authorized you? Who were your clients? Who asked you to create these false documents? And who authorized that activity? And that would have gone up to the executives at all the major banks in America.
Is this company still in business?
DocX is no longer in business. And Linda Green actually did go to jail. She was the only one who went to jail for this situation. But when they indicted her, they said that she created these fictitious documents unbeknownst to her clients, as if, you know, these banks were asking for this information because without it, they would not be able to foreclose. But they didn't know it was going to be fake, right? So it's just kind of a silly situation when they said that she was liable for a conspiracy, but it was a conspiracy of one.
And Lynn did win her whistleblower lawsuit.
Yeah, so there was a separate lawsuit unrelated to the Jacksonville criminal case. There was a civil lawsuit that she filed, what's known as a QI-TAM case. And that was filed on behalf of the federal government because under the False Claims Act, the companies like Wells Fargo and Bank of America were making these claims based on these fictitious documents. They were getting money from the U.S. government. And so there was a settlement in that case, $95 million settlement that the government won. And because Lynn was a whistleblower in that case, she was entitled to $18 million out of that statute.
David Dayan is a journalist and author of the new book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And if you have any questions for David about the information that he uncovered and what he learned from the three people he profiled in his book, we'd love to hear from you. If you have been affected by a foreclosure or know someone who has, share your story. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, David, in the most simplistic terms, can you describe what actually happened? Because I know there are still people out there who believe that irresponsible citizens signed the dotted line and they should not have taken the loan, and it's their fault that they lost their house.
Right. And that's the standard narrative that the industry pushes on foreclosure, that
right.
these people are deadbeats, that they it's all their fault, they missed their mortgage payment, and that's the end of the story. The truth is there's two sides to a lending contract. There's a borrower, and the borrower has responsibilities, and the lender also has responsibilities. For example, that they don't give a loan out to someone unless they have the ability to repay. In addition, in this case, the foreclosures themselves were kind of pushed by the mortgage servicing industry. In Lisa's case, for example, she was told she needed to miss three payments in order to be eligible for a loan modification. And so she, even though it was against everything in her being, she's never missed a payment on anything in her life. Her credit score was 803, but she had no choice, and so she missed these three payments, and then they put her into foreclosure. This was a very common technique, it really driving people into foreclosure. And so that has to be accounted for in this narrative. And then the fact that the ownership records were lost and they were using false evidence, it doesn't really matter if people missed a mortgage payment. If you're using false evidence to try to convict them in court, it's no different than planting the gun on a suspect, a criminal suspect, and saying, well, it doesn't matter because that criminal suspect is guilty of murder. There is a standard around the integrity of our court system. And if you break that integrity, I believe that you should not be able to go through with whatever it is you want to do.
And yet they did.
Yeah.
So how are they able to do this?
Well, the judicial system is kind of small-c conservative. They don't want to create a situation where millions of mortgages would not be able to be enforced in terms of the foreclosure. You know, think about a judge who has two adversaries in a case, and one of them is a bank lawyer who's in a very nice suit, who you know, is someone he might have gone to school with in college, and then the other guy is a pro se litigant acting in their own case, a foreclosure victim who missed mortgage payments. Now, you know, culturally and socially, who is he going to side with in that argument? And you know, what I was told is that, you know, judges want to disrupt things the least that they possibly can. And so they didn't want to create the situation where in their mind, people got a free house on a technicality. And that was sort of the ice that the defense lawyers had to cut through to say, no, this is about false evidence. This is about the integrity of your courtroom. And that was a very difficult thing to get through to judges.
What about state politicians, for example? Did they take action? Because as you report, in Florida, by 2009, one of every four Floridians with a mortgage was either behind on payments or in foreclosure. One in every four. The numbers here in California were also massive.
In many areas, yes. It's kind of incredible that we think about sort of this election and how people are asking, why is everyone angry? Why is everyone angry? You know, there isn't a person who hasn't been touched. I mean, so many people have been touched by this foreclosure crisis, the largest economic downturn since the Great Depression, and they feel like government didn't get on their side, that the system was sort of rigged against them, and that government didn't come to the rescue. They did not help them. And this loss of faith in the institution of government to be some, you know, a problem-solving entity and in their mission to protect the public is, I think, partially responsible for a lot of the tumult that we're seeing, you know, on the left and on the right, with anti-establishment figures saying, you know, your government failed you, and this is, you know, come to me for you know, the better answer.
Hmm. Well, after the break, I'd like to talk more about government. The FBI's criminal division warned about fraudulent practices in 2004,
yeah,
but it didn't go anywhere. A lot of people in the media are talking about President Obama's legacy. Well, what about this? I mean, what did the Obama do or not do to deal with mortgage fraud? Today, we're joined by journalist David Dayen. His new book is called Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And what they found is that millions of people, families really, were kicked out of their homes based on false evidence by mortgage companies that had no legal right to foreclose. Between 2006 and 2014, more than 9 million homeowners went through a foreclosure or lost their homes to foreclosure. This is still happening today. So what will it take to end it? And will anyone be held responsible? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You can call us on the telephone, you may send an email, you may go to our website, or you may tweet us. Our email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Our website where you can leave a comment is yourcallradio.org, and our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. World Have Your Say from the BBC coming up in just a half an hour at 11 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow on a much lighter note, we're going to have a conversation about free and low-cost local events, museums, nature walks, and concerts. Summer is not over yet, and lucky for us, the Bay Area is packed with amazing things to do and sights to see. So that's tomorrow. Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we'll be talking about a really good investigation in the New York Times about think tanks and their influence across the country. In fact, their influence here in San Francisco. I hope you can check out that piece and then join us on Friday. Today, we are joined by journalist David Dayan. He's a contributing writer to Salon and The Intercept. He's been on the show many times. His new book is called Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David tells the story of three people who were the victims of foreclosure. They uncovered an unparalleled pattern of deceit used by mortgage companies to take people's homes away. This is still happening today. No one really has been held responsible. So what will it take to end this? If you have any questions for David about what happened, about what he uncovered, if you or someone you know lost your home, we'd love to hear your story. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. This should be an election year issue. Unfortunately, it's not, but it really should be near the top of the list. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Sharon. She writes, "What is the connection between Pacific Security Real Estate and Wells Fargo? A neighbor was foreclosed years ago by Wells, and it was handled by Security Pacific. Since then, I have noticed similar patterns in our Berkeley neighborhood of vacant and foreclosed houses. What is the probability that this real estate company is in the pocket of Wells Fargo that avoids County Hall of Justice steps public auctioning of houses foreclosed? It appears that it's security ownership is fraud."
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not familiar with security ownership or whatever the name of that is, but often banks use specific real estate companies when they take back a home in an eviction process. They'll use a specific real estate company who will then resell the property. And there's a lot of penny ante fraud that goes about that. There was a movie called 99 Homes that is specifically about the use of real estate brokers to do these situations where they'll take the air conditioning unit out and say they had to replace the air conditioning unit, and they'll make money off of reinstalling that unit. I mean, a lot of penny ante scams that go on. That's the interesting thing about this book is that not only was there this big fraud that you're talking about, but there was all this little penny ante fraud at every level of the process. Somebody was trying to get their little portion, their little take out of this system, profiting off of these foreclosures.
And I should mention that David has two events today. He'll be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park today at noon, 1010 El Camino Real, and then he'll be at Book Passage in San Francisco tonight at 6, One Ferry Building. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Sharon, thank you for your email. We have another email from Eileen. Can you talk more about Mortgage Electronic Registration System, MERS, particularly the effect on the income to county governments, i.e. property ownership changes, used to be registered in the county. Counties made money every time property changed hands. With MERS, the registration was supposed to be registered electronically, so denying counties income. It's responsible for elections and many services we depend on.
The emailer is absolutely right. It used to cost anywhere from $35 to $50 every time a mortgage changed hands. And the banking system realized that if they're going to do this securitization and make like seven transfers on every one mortgage, that's going to get very expensive. And so they effectively privatized that entire system. They created this electronic private database that a company, MERS, which is owned outright by the big banks and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, They only have 60 employees. All they have is a spreadsheet, a database. It's just an Excel document, basically, and it tracks 60 million mortgages in the United States. And every time those mortgages are transferred, it's supposed to be put in on the ledger in the spreadsheet, but the county government doesn't know anything about it. And they are deprived of billions of dollars. There have been lawsuits to go after that money. There was a settlement in Portland, in Multnomah County in Portland. There was another settlement in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. You know, it depends on those county offices as to whether they want to fight this and try to, you know, get the money that they were deserved when all these transfers were made. The other problem is that there's no troubleshooting on this MERS system. It's all done inside this database. There's nobody doing double checks. Thousands of people have access to this database, and it's as susceptible to error as you would expect. If it's just this private thing, they forget to put the transfers in. It's a privatization of a system that is really sort of the bulwark of capitalism and commerce, you know? I mean, you have to be able to buy or sell a property with the confidence that nobody else has a claim on it. That's why we wanted to make this system public. And with no legislative input, the banking system just privatized it.
And as you report, foreclosure fraud, we're told, is a thing of the past, right? We're in a recovery right now. That happened back then. Right. But you report that this is still happening every day.
Yeah, right. I mean, as I said in the beginning, I get letters and emails all the time from people. It is still going on. Every day in America, someone is thrown out of their home based on a false document. That's because it's impossible to sort of – when you break the chain of title, which is the chain of ownership and transfer, it's really kind of impossible to unbreak it. So they just keep using different false documents that might look a little better in order to cover this over, paper this over, and move forward. And the judges – and the political system has what I would call foreclosure fatigue. They don't want to talk about this anymore. They just want to move on. And so I think you're just going to continue to see this churn through the system until people get, ground out.
Well, we have a related question about this. Let's hear from Elaine in San Francisco. Hi, Elaine. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was interested in if you have any projections as to whether there's going to be another burst in the big bubble, because things are the market seems to be skyrocketing the way it had been previously.
Yeah, I mean, certainly here in San Francisco, there is a significant housing price bubble. That's not true everywhere in the country. What we saw during the housing bubble is that it was everywhere that was going up. Astronomically. Now we have it sort of regionally. There's a severe housing affordability crisis in places like San Francisco. So I don't know if that's due for a crash or not. I guess I'm not as well versed in the specifics of the San Francisco housing system. But I will say that some of the worst practices have been banned in terms of the mortgages that are being issued. We have a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau now that is a little more attentive to consumer protection. And I think the next financial crisis isn't necessarily going to happen in the same way that the last one did. But there's no question that San Francisco is looking pretty bubbly right now.
Yeah, we're definitely going to do a show on this in the future. I just read that about 8,000 to 10,000 new condos are coming on the market this year. And they're already having a hard time renting some. And so they're offering like a month's rent free, for example.
The problem is that all of these homes that are being built, and we do need building of more properties in places like San Francisco. But the problem is that they're all being built at the luxury level.
Right.
They're not being built at the market rate.
Yep.
And so nobody can afford them. So it's not really enough to just build more and expect that through supply and demand the price will come down if you're building everything at the luxury level.
I was looking at one new building, $3,500 for a studio and $8,500 a month for a three-bedroom.
Wow.
Thank you for calling in, Elaine. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions for David Dayan about foreclosures and what he uncovered, he's been covering this for years now. He gets so many emails every day from people who are still losing their homes. And if you or someone you know dealt with a foreclosure, we'd love to hear your story. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to go back to accountability because I think this is really important. Mm-hmm. You report that in September 2004, the FBI's criminal division, the FBI, formally warned of a mortgage fraud epidemic with more than 12,000 cases of suspicious activity. Chris Swecker, assistant director of the FBI unit, said, quote, "If fraudulent practices become systemic within the mortgage industry, it will ultimately place financial institutions at risk and have adverse effects on the stock market," end quote. Despite this awareness, almost no effort was put into stamping out the fraud. In fact, you report that when Georgia tried to protect borrowers with a strong anti-predatory lending law in 2002, every participant in the mortgage industry, public and private, bore down on them. Ameriquest pulled all business from the state. Two ratings agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, said they would not rate securities backed by loans from Georgia, cutting off the state from the primary mode of funding mortgages.
Yeah, that was a major event that the state of Georgia actually tried to do something about this. And it wasn't just the mortgage industry that said, okay, we'll pull out, but it was the rating agencies. It was the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the regulator, who said, you can't do this. Fannie and Freddie, who were government-sponsored, said, we're going to pull out. So, the state was effectively blackmailed into repealing their anti-predatory lending law. And, that 2004 FBI report just shows that, there's this kind of myth that nobody saw the housing bubble coming. And in fact, everybody saw the housing bubble coming. They just were unwilling to do anything about it because it was propping up the economy at that point in some ways. That's kind of a corrective on that sort of mythology that this was an unseen tornado or something. No, this was very well known. This was coming down the pike, and we knew that borrowers were going to be in a heap of trouble, and yet we allowed that to happen.
Did any other states try to take action?
Not after Georgia. I mean, not after the experience of Georgia.
Wow.
It had a very chilling effect on efforts at the state level to fight mortgage fraud, and as well it should have, because the whole industry came down and the regulators came down on Georgia.
We have an email from Benjamin. Can you please comment on non-judicial foreclosures in California and the recording of false documents, invalid foreclosures? These recordings have not necessarily stopped, even with the California Homeowners Bill of Rights. Only if a homeowner sues will a judge view the documents.
Yeah. So there are two different types of ways in which mortgage companies can foreclose. There are judicial foreclosure states like Florida. My story takes place in Florida, and that's where a judge, an entity foreclosing actually has to get a judge's ruling, that they have to take you to court and say, we're taking your home away, and you have the chance to defend yourself. And then there are states like California and Arizona and Nevada, which are non-judicial states, where you don't have to go to a judge to get a foreclosure order. You post a notice of default, and there are a variety of steps. But it's up to the individual homeowner to affirmatively, try to get their case heard. And that puts the burden of proof on the homeowner rather than the burden of proof being on the mortgage company. So non-judicial states are much better for the banking industry, and California is one of them. Your writer alluded to the fact that these documents are still being filed in these cases. Because they weren't in court cases, it was just easier to find these documents in Florida. And so that's why I focused on Florida, and that's why a lot of the activity, the citizens' movement to fight foreclosure fraud, really came out of Florida.
So have any Florida politicians taken action on this to ensure this doesn't happen again?
Well, I mean, there were people who sort of made a lot. There was a Homeowners Bill of Rights attempt in Florida as well, and it ended up not going anywhere. The political system kind of routed this out. The Attorney General of Florida, who came in 2011, Pam Bondi, She ended up firing prosecutors in her office, which were actually looking into foreclosure fraud. And then when asked when she did it, they put out this report from the Inspector General's office that said that those prosecutors were too close to Lisa Epstein and Lynn Simoniak, the two of the subjects of my book, and that they were manipulating the prosecutors into trying to get them a free house, which is just absolutely crazy. And of course, Pam Bondi had a lot of money coming in from banks that helped her in her election effort. So it's, I guess, in some ways not surprising.
And then going back to people who were not held responsible, you write that politicians did not heed the cries for help. All of these homeowners who exposed this information, and they easily knuckled under to the persuasions of the financial services industry. Talk about what the Obama administration could have done to deal with this.
Well, the Obama administration could have brought criminal prosecutions. I mean, you have millions of pieces of false evidence, fraudulent evidence that were issued into courts and county offices. It's police work 101 to take those pieces of paper that have signatures on them and go to the people on those signatures and say, you know, who authorized you to do this? And then go to those people and say, well, who asked you to create these fictitious documents? And if you go up the chain, you'll get to the executives at the major banks in all of the major banks in this country. The Justice Department wasn't interested in doing that. They cut settlements with all these banks for pennies on the dollar that really didn't go to help homeowners in a meaningful way. I don't think you can tell the story of the Obama administration without telling this story, that they were weak in their efforts to protect homeowners. Millions of them lost their homes. And then when they had this maximum leverage, when they found out that the banks were actually foreclosing illegally on all these homeowners, they did not use that information to get a more equitable result for homeowners across the country. And it's, you know, I mean, President Obama has done a lot of good things, and you can talk about health care, and you can talk about, you know, all of the other things that they've been able to move forward. But this has to be part of the legacy.
You also report that the Obama economic team resisted a policy called cram down, which mm-hmm. would have allowed bankruptcy judges to modify terms on primary resident mortgages as they can other debt contracts. It seems like this would have helped so many people.
Yes.
But you report that liberal lawmakers believed this threat of bankruptcy modifications would give homeowners needed leverage to negotiate relief, although then-Senator Obama endorsed cram down on the 2008 campaign trail. Banks even held meetings to prepare for its eventuality. His administration pressured congressional leaders against including it in must-pass bills like the economic stimulus. And we should say he packed his economic team with Wall Street executives.
With executives or people who are friendly to Wall Street ideas,
right.
People like Timothy Geithner, who was at the New York Federal Reserve, or Larry Summers, people like that. So, this cram down thing was a huge deal because this would have given homeowners some leverage to negotiate better terms. If they had the threat of saying, okay, well, I'll go into bankruptcy and then the judge will rewrite the terms of my mortgage, then banks would have been more willing to negotiate deals and get loan modifications so people could stay in their homes. And that didn't happen.
And when this came up as a standalone bill,
right.
And how did it make it into a standalone bill? Because that's kind of a big deal in and of itself in climate.
So, I mean, this was back in 2009 when the Democrats had a major majority in Congress,
right.
In both houses of Congress. But if it was in a must-pass bill, something like the stimulus or even the TARP program, it would have had a much better chance of passage. When you put it in just a bill alone by itself, you put a target on its back. And what happened is it passed the House barely. And then in the Senate, some pro-bank senators didn't vote for it.
Democrats.
Pro-bank Democratic right. senators didn't vote for it. And Dick Durbin very famously in a radio interview after that said the banks frankly own the place, referring to Congress.
I remember that. Yeah, it's so easy to forget that the Dems controlled everything in 2009.
Right.
Because things, you know, today are nothing gets done
right.
for various reasons. But they could have really done something about this back
particularly
then.
If it was put into something like the stimulus, which everyone knew was going to pass in some form, or in the TARP program, which had to pass That was the bank bailout, the TARP program. So by isolating it, it was effectively killing it. So when Obama made the decision, keep it out of these must-pass bills, keep it out of these must-pass bills, that was the death knell for this policy.
So, I mean, a lot of people are very cynical about what's happening right now because you have a revolving door. Mm-hmm. One day you're the Goldman Sachs executive CEO. The next day you run the Treasury Department. I mean, this is so common in this country.
Right.
And they're getting so much money from Wall Street. I mean, look at Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Why do you think, at the end of the day, the Obama administration did not take action on this?
Well, I mean, there are a number of reasons. You have to look first at the Justice Department, which at the time was run by Eric Holder, and the head of the criminal division was Lanny Breuer. They came from Covington & Burling, a law firm that represents bank clients. And they were of a corporate lawyer mindset that we're not going to present a case, a criminal case, unless we absolutely know that we're going to get a conviction, which is, I think, the wrong way for a federal prosecutor to think. And it was true, definitely, that the administration, from Timothy Geithner on down, they were more concerned with bank balance sheets than homeowner balance sheets. And, you know, there are books out there like House of Debt by Atif Mian and Amir Sufi, which makes the argument that this was the biggest mistake of the Obama administration, that when they failed to stop this debt problem of foreclosures, that created the situation that made us a slower recovery because people couldn't engage in consumer spending when they were worried that they were going to lose their house. So this was not just a bad idea morally to not hold anyone accountable and to prefer banks over homeowners, but it was a bad problem economically. And we would have had a stronger recovery if we would have done it differently.
David Dayan is author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. This is a thick book that's full of very important information. We've done a lot of shows about this, and he provides a lot of new information about this fraud. And David will be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park today at noon, 1010 El Camino Real. He'll be at Books Passage here in San Francisco tonight at 6, 1 Ferry Building. And we have a few more minutes for some emails. Leslie writes, what role do title companies have in this?
Yeah, title companies are the companies that sort of guarantee with insurance that you have clear title, that the chain of title is unbroken on your loan. And initially in 2010, when every mortgage company stopped foreclosing because all this evidence was getting out, the title company said, we're not going to sell these homes anymore because we don't think that the title is clear on them. The title industry is very much sort of hand in hand with the mortgage industry, and eventually they came around, and the title industry said, "Okay, we'll go ahead and sell these properties." So, title insurance, while important, was not effective in this case to prevent the tide of false documents, even though it started out that way.
And we have another email from Thomas in Berkeley. This is related to the show on Monday we did about private equity firms now controlling various social services. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on these private equity companies buying up hundreds of millions of dollars of foreclosed homes here in California and many other states, reducing the amount of the homes for sale to families looking for homes, not wanting to rent them?
Yeah. So companies like Blackstone, a private equity firm, have bought up all of these foreclosed homes at a discount, sometimes in auctions from the federal government, from the Housing and Urban Development Department. And then they've renovated them barely and then put them up for rent. So there's this tide of single-family rentals where Wall Street is your landlord. And they're not a very good landlord, by the way. They're an absentee kind of slumlord in many ways. And so, yes, it reduces the housing stock available. It also, you know, what they're trying to do is hold these homes in rental. They're selling the rental revenue as a mortgage, a rental-backed security. So they're creating a similar situation as the mortgage-backed securities during the housing bubble. And what they want to do is when the price goes up, they want to dump out of that market and sell the homes, which would then, you know, these people, many of them foreclosed themselves, who then just found another place. Now they're renting the home that they used to own or something like that. Then if the Blackstone up and, you know, sells these things on a mass scale, what happens to the people that were renting these homes? So it's a serious problem. I know that it has been looked at in various places in California, but I don't think we have a total handle on what's going on.
A few media outlets have reported that Blackstone executives have held fundraisers for Hillary Clinton. They are supporting her campaign. What do you think she will do about this?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, they held a big cocktail party at the DNC that I actually managed to sneak into. It was Tony James, who's the COO and president of Blackstone, and a big Hillary Clinton fundraiser, held this event. And like, you know, Rahm Emanuel was there and Larry Summers was there and all these major bigwigs of the Obama administration economic team who might end up in a Clinton administration economic team. What's interesting is that Hillary Clinton has said, well, the real problem with the financial system is the shadow banks. She said the big banks aren't the problem. The problem is the shadow banks. Well, that's what Blackstone is. They're a private equity firm. They're a shadow bank. And so why are you taking this support from the heads of a company that you say represents the major threat to the financial system? I think she needs to be challenged on that.
It would be nice if the media would ask her about this. to this point, though, I mean, we have a few people writing in saying we keep having the same conversation and nothing is changing.
Right. Well, I would say maybe something is changing because this book is sort of about people who sacrifice everything to go up against these big financial institutions. And they don't get every single goal that they set out for. They don't get many of the goals that they set out for. However, they did create some forward energy. What I say about movements, and this was really the start of a movement, they sort of crash on the shore like waves, and each one gets a little bit closer and a little bit closer. Without these activists, you know, who are fighting foreclosure fraud, you don't get Occupy Wall Street. And without Occupy Wall Street, you don't get the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party. And without that, you don't get the Bernie Sanders campaign. And without that, you don't get this forward energy where both parties in their party platforms say, we need to break up the banks. We need to restore the Glass-Steagall firewall between investment and commercial banks. So, you know, things happen slowly. It's very laborious. It's like cutting through ice. But things do change. And I think the conversation around the banking industry has changed.
Well, it is a great book. Thank you for exposing and sharing all of this information. David Dayan's book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And if you're free this afternoon, David will be at Kepler's in Menlo Park at noon, 1010 El Camino Real, or tonight at 6, Book Passage in San Francisco at 1 Ferry Building. David, thanks for writing the book and thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about free and low-cost local events, museums, nature walks, and concerts. Summer isn't over, and the Bay Area is packed with places to go and sights to see. So what are your recommendations for the best free and affordable things to do while the sun is still shining? What are your favorite kid-friendly activities? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.